From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the Wisconsin Policy Forum looks at the financial outlook for MPS, the state's largest school district. Then the On the Wing program gives sketchbooks to at-risk Milwaukeeans. Some of these pieces are now featured in an exhibit.
Combining the House of Peace sketchbooks with the local artist community sketchbooks completely dismantled any notion of who's better or what's worth more money.
Hopefully there's not a sticky wicket with Milwaukee's upcoming cricket battle, and the loss of Native American languages can mean the erosion of their cultures and their religions.
The ceremonies have to be in the native language. There's a guy named Jim Thunder who is an elder up in Forest County Potawatomi tribe. He says, when God doesn't hear our language spoken, he'll consider their tribe to be extinct.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. The school year is drawing to a close, but Milwaukee Public Schools is in the middle of figuring out its 2019-2020 budget. Superintendent Keith Posley has proposed a plan that protects classrooms from cuts, and it adds about 100 new positions and provides a 2.44% salary increase for staff. Wisconsin Policy Forum researchers Ann Chapman and Rob Hankin say the budget accomplishes this with one-time fiscal maneuvers, cuts to the central office, and drawing down monies from construction funds. But in a budget brief released last week, the researchers point out that MPS's financial future is likely to change. Republican lawmakers are pushing for a $500 million K-12 spending increase. That's much less than Governor Evers wants, but nonetheless it would mean more money for NPS. WUWM's Emily Files spoke with Hankin and Chapman about the financial outlook for Wisconsin's largest school district.
This was a very difficult budget to size up because on the one hand, you do see what seems like an easing of the fiscal pressures, the fact that these 108 positions were able to be created, the fact that an inflationary salary increase, school budgets were kept whole and even increased a little bit, and even the central service reductions, which has really been a key component of the new superintendent's plan, those were kept relatively to a minimum. On the other hand, however, you look at that, you juxtapose that with the count with the MPS's long-term fiscal outlook, and you see that if revenues stay flat, these fiscal pressures are going to continue to grow. And I think one thing that often gets obscured is, so we can say that there are some increases in this budget and things don't look as bad, but when you really think about the types of fundamental investments that a district with the challenges like MPS would ideally want to be making in its teacher workforce and in all sorts of instructional areas, that often gets lost as they go from budget to budget, just sort of trying to get by.
So Keith Posley has been at the helm of MPS for about a year now. When he took over as interim superintendent, he completely changed his predecessor, Darian Driver's budget. So how would you describe Keith Posley's overall budget strategy?
His main goal with this budget was to keep the schools whole. So the main departure that was implemented last budget, which was initially proposed by Dr. Driver, was sort of trying to balance needed cuts between the schools and the central services. And they were trying to make that sort of heavier on central services than the schools, but there were some cuts. When Dr. Posley came in, he found money through various means, cutting central services, and found some new federal money to put all the money back in the schools. And so they didn't make a cut last year, and that was his goal again this year. So that was the main thing. And then they followed through with that. There were a number of sort of one-time fiscal maneuvers that they found that they were able to do this year that likely will not be something they could lean on next year. But all told, they were able to keep the schools whole.
So can you talk more about these one-time fiscal maneuvers and the fact that Superintendent Posley, in order to protect classrooms, is drawing heavily from the construction fund and central office, cutting positions in central office? Can you talk more about those decisions and the implications?
So the construction fund is just sort of, it's exemplary of what we see in governments and school districts that are facing severe fiscal pressure. One of the first things that often goes in a government that is in severe fiscal distress is that they put off taking care of their infrastructure. We also see that there was a one-time maneuver, a separate chunk of surplus from the construction fund, $4.3 million, was actually put into school operations, but that's for minor maintenance. But these are the types of things that you don't want to see repeat themselves year after year.
Yeah, and in terms of the cuts that they've made to central services, several of their central offices, they made some cuts. Other offices, they made increases. So the main area where it looks like the cuts probably happened is in the area of academics. So it's hard to discern the impact that that might have. And like we said, they have to find ways of finding savings. So there isn't a criticism here, but what we say in the analysis is, to the extent that they're making cuts in offices, for example, that are charged with things like educator effectiveness, professional development, new teacher induction and support. We just say that this should be something that is looked at on an ongoing basis in terms of what is the impact for how the district can serve its needs and its teachers and its students.
And I would just add that so we do similar analyses of the City of Milwaukee budget and Milwaukee County budget every year. And this is, again, not unique to MPS. In this sort of desperate attempt to stave off service cuts, oftentimes the first thing that goes are administrative positions. And again, as a general rule, it's hard to argue with that approach. But we look at Milwaukee County, for example, where there are no longer deputy directors in many large departments and where research analysts and budget analysts have been trimmed. And it starts to really impact the ability of the government to sort of dig its way out of its problems because they don't have the staff capacity to do the types of research and analysis and so forth.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the reaction that this MPS budget has been getting at public hearings. I'm going to play some audio from the most recent public hearing on the MPS budget.
We cannot attract and retain qualified teachers.
And from the day I walked in the door, I have been consistently and constantly disrespected by this administration in more ways than one, but most of all, in what we're being paid.
It's time our educational assistants get a salary schedule that compensates them.
I'm looking into donating plasma this summer to make ends meet.
So even though this budget spares classrooms, cuts, and even adds some teaching positions, the reaction from the current MPS employees has been pretty skeptical or even negative, saying that there needs to be a more appealing work environment to retain the current staff and even fill the positions that exist. So what do you think about the employee reaction to the budget?
It speaks to the sort of the rock and the hard place that the district is in. At first, the reaction last year to the budget when Dr. Driver unveiled it, when there were pretty significant cuts to schools, the tone felt very similar to the reaction this year, where there was an effort to keep things status quo. And so status quo seems like, compared to last year, seems like an improvement. But status quo is not where the district wants to be. Status quo is not where the teachers want to be. Status quo is not where the district needs to be to attract and retain teachers, which it really needs to do, because turnover at MPS is relatively high, and turnover is not good for student outcomes.
Part of the issue, of course, is Madison, and there's just a finite amount of resources. So to do the things that are that some of those who are testifying suggest need to be done, there either needs to be increased revenue, which now we may see some of that increased revenue, or there has to be another look at where else could dollars be cut from the existing MPS budget without sacrificing teacher workforce issues, et cetera. And we do point out in this report that there are two areas in particular. One is transportation, the other is facilities, that have been looked at before and that clearly are going to have to be on the table. Now, of course, with both, there are impacts. And so these aren't easy things to do. If they were easy, they would have been done already. But really, our take is that there needs to be some concerted effort on both sides of the equation, both the expenditure side and the revenue side, if we are to try to make a dent on these teacher compensation issues, which clearly are a real issue for the district.
MPS is the biggest district in the state, and it serves a high concentration of low-income students of color, students who are coming into school with a lot of needs and with a lot of disadvantages. So how does MPS's financial situation affect the district's ability to give these students the education and the support that they need?
Well, so we have not taken a deep dive into issues like the mental health services that are being provided by MPS. But clearly, there are areas from guidance counselors to nurses to behavioral health professionals and so forth, where we certainly hear anecdotally that the demand for those types of services far exceeds the supply in terms of what MPS is able to provide. So clearly, you know, these are the areas. As we focus on the real major areas, can you keep enough teachers in your classrooms to avoid class sizes from growing even more out of control and so forth? Those tend to be the top priorities. Sort of, you know, obscured by all of that is what's going on underneath. And are we providing the types of supports that the economically disadvantaged student population that MPS is trying to serve, that population really needs? And we can't quantify that. We can't say, you know, the extent to which that is being done or not being done. But clearly, it's a challenge, and fiscal instability is not helpful in terms of meeting that challenge.
And to go along with that, just to sort of highlight a nuance there, is that MPS's revenue limit, so the main source of its resources, is right in the middle of all the school districts in the state. It's not especially low or especially high. But the issue is, because it has students that have these additional needs, it has to divert a lot of those resources just to meet those basic needs of the kids. And maybe it's not even mental health sort of crisis resources, but it's guidance counselors to help those kids figure out how to apply to college, because they maybe don't have the resources at home that other kids do. So it, you know, on this, you could look at the dollars and say, oh, they're right in the middle, you know, but they don't have as much access to those dollars for sort of promoting and advancing students as much as meeting basic needs.
Wisconsin Policy Forum researchers Ann Chapman and Rob Hankin spoke with WUWM's education reporter Emily Files. There's a link to the forum's MPS budget brief at WUWM.com. Coming up next, a look at the On the Wing program, which gives at-risk Milwaukeeans sketchbooks, plus an exhibition of their work. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Sketchbooks offer an intimate look at the soul of an artist. An exhibition at the Portrait Society Gallery in Milwaukee's Third Ward is putting those souls on display. The exhibition features sketchbooks from the gallery's On the Wing project, which gives sketchbooks and art supplies to Milwaukeeans at the House of Peace Community Center. The project encourages people to draw in that sketchbook, and for their efforts, they're paid $50 for each completed one. Gallery owner Deborah Bramer created the program a few years ago, and she decided to feature those sketchbooks at her gallery along with some sketchbooks from other artists. She and local artist Pat Hitson, who works with the On the Wing project, joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to tell us more.
Well, I've had the gallery in the Third Ward for 10 years now, and it's one of the city's most prominent contemporary art galleries. And the gallery has always had an emphasis on diversity and showing just a wide range of artists. And after, you know, 8 years of doing this, I realized we needed to take another step and get into a broader neighborhood, cross the great race divide.
I was at an art opening, and Deborah presented her idea to all of us, and she explained how when she was observing the homeless population and aspects of the population that normally a gallery owner wouldn't be able to have access to in terms of how do you engage, she said she wanted us to start to contribute to a fund so that she could distribute sketchbooks to them.
So how did you start to, you know, bridge that divide?
So I've always been interested in the sketchbook. I carry them with me. My purse is full. When I travel, I always keep a sketchbook. I taught art history at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design for 10 years. And in order to engage art students in art history, I realized if they worked in sketchbooks, they were much more grounded with the visual. So it was a natural extension to think about how can we move into other communities with the idea of doing sketchbooks, which are open-ended. It's not about creating a great work of art or a masterpiece. It's about process. It's about exploring one page after another page after another page and taking risks and playing and seeing where it takes you. So that was very appealing. And we thought, well, let's see about working with homeless populations. So we first went to the St. Ben's Meal Program, where there's 350 meals served every night that are organized by the Capuchins, monks. And that was a little hit or miss. We were like, hey, everybody, do you want to make a sketchbook? We'll pay you $50 for the finished thing. And, you know, walking around the tables, handing out sketchbooks, it was very hard to get them back. We'd come back the next week, but the population was pretty transient, and so it just wasn't working. And then one of the House of Peace brothers said, you should come to the House of Peace and try to do this there, and we'll support you. So they gave us a room, and it's right in the center. Our door is open. Everybody can see the class, and it's just worked out beautifully.
When you walk into the building, it is truly just one of the most my prized moments during my week, because the community is gathered. The community members are running the place in the most wonderful way. It's such a pleasure to work with them. And there are all our people around the table, all happy and can't wait to get started. And you walk in and you just feel like, oh my gosh, this is just awesome.
You know, you've called the program On the Wing. What is the significance of that name?
Well, we called it On the Wing because it became apparent that when you work in a sketchbook, when you focus and you draw, you actually really do take flight from your daily troubles and your daily stress. It's something we learned in doing the project that is so apparent, and just about everyone who participates in the project has this moment when they realize, this is incredible. I just spent an hour so focused in this other world of exploration and discovery and color, and all the rest of my stresses, all the tension, all the struggles, whatever you bring to that table, when you arrive, it's gone. So On the Wing seemed like a pertinent title for the project.
Now, Pat, you're involved with the House of Peace. For those who may not know what it is, what do they do there?
Well, they provide many different services. They work with Marquette, UWM, various schools, and other providers of resources for the community. So it might be help with your insurance, help with eyeglasses, help with health care. There will be people there from the UWM Nursing School, for example. They do programs. They do instructional programs concerning like perhaps wills or other kinds of things that people need that kind of professional support, and that they certainly wouldn't be able to just walk into a lawyer's office and pay that kind of money kind of thing. But I think that that's also a very spiritually based place, in the sense that people are honored and given a sense, I think, of safety there, and that everyone who walks in is part of the community.
They also have a food bank and a clothing distribution site.
So a lot of times our people will come in, and they often will have carrying carts, it's fun to see what they've gotten that day. Sometimes they'll pull out, oh, look what I got, a lamp. And other times it'll be apples or fresh fruit or bread or things like that.
So a lot of what you've mentioned here is support in various different ways. How do the sketchbooks kind of play into that idea of supporting this community?
Well, when I started, I was working at the cathedral for Deb with this project. And in that, at the cathedral, everyone I worked with was actually homeless. And immediately, it was apparent how the sketchbook engaged people in a kind of conversation where they could flow with their thoughts and they didn't feel like they were in a private, safe place, and they could tell their story. And the whole time they're drawing. So while they're drawing, they're very relaxed, and they're talking about themselves in a much more deep way.
One of the things you mentioned earlier in the conversation was that you pay people for their sketchbooks, which I thought was really interesting.
That wasn't a very important component of the project. We're going into the community and drawing once a week for an hour. And, you know, that's asking people for their time. Even if it's a really valuable thing to do, we are asking them to take it seriously, asking people for their time. And then when they finish a sketchbook, the $50 really says, you know, this is of value. You made something really important here. And because this is a community that doesn't tend to have great visibility or power or voice, putting forth that sketchbook as a concrete object that will stay in the world is a monumental act. And we want to make sure that that's understood and honored. And you know what? It's a great way for people to make a little extra money who are prone to, you know, working and doing artwork and becoming a part of this and sticking with it. We have some participants who have really been coming to the House of Peace over a year or a year and a half every week, that it's become a part of their life and they've become pretty amazing artists. They were probably already amazing artists, but we gave them a place to share what they were doing and a reason to keep doing it.
Well, now you have this exhibit that shows a number of these sketchbooks. You know, when people go to the exhibit, what are they going to see? What's inside of these books?
They are going to see so many images that they could never imagine. A lot of them all put together in ways that they couldn't imagine. A lot of color, a lot of interesting drawings of settings, of coming from people's lives, things that were their favorite things. They'll read poems. They'll read comments. The comments that the people have made about their lives, very honest comments, because there's writing interspersed in the books. And also, artists from the artist community here in Milwaukee were invited to participate. So there are 50 local artists involved in the project who were very happy to get involved and put their heart and souls into their sketchbooks too. And all of these sketchbooks are all interspersed in the show so that there's no differentiation, the way everything is beautifully displayed and very professionally hung. And posters were made of a lot of the different artists' work. And some of the most fun, amazing posters are done from our House of Peace people because they're just delightful.
It isn't easy to interrupt the hierarchy in the art world in Milwaukee. It's a segregated city. It's very divided. No matter how much attention is brought to it, we still have very white audiences. And this project really successfully did that, combining the House of Peace sketchbooks with the local artist community sketchbooks completely dismantled any notion of who's better or what's worth more money. All of the sketchbooks are for sale for $100. So that was like a remarkable part of this project.
And the opening, our fundraising opening, was truly a dream come true because the community was completely all mixed up and everybody was talking to everybody. And it was just completely like all as one.
Nice. Well, Deborah, Pat, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Joy.
Deborah Bramer is the owner and director of the Portrait Society Gallery, located in Milwaukee's 3rd Ward. Pat Hitson is a local artist who works with the On the Wing project at the House of Peace. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and there is more information about the exhibit and the project at WUWM.com. Wickets, overs, and bowlers, oh my. Cricket comes to Milwaukee, and we'll find out more when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Bucks may be done for the season, and it's early days for the Brewers. But if you're jonesing for a sports fix with a twist, consider cricket. The Cricket World Cup is going on in England and Wales as we speak, and in July, Milwaukeeans can watch the sport in person. From July 4th through the 7th, for the first time in the United States, the state versus state cricket competition takes place at three local parks. And that's thanks in great part to our next guest, Dr. Abdur Choudhury. Dr. Choudhury is a professor emeritus of economics at Marquette University, and he's the president of the National Cricket League, Incorporated. He recently joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke to explain why he thinks the time is right for professional cricket in the United States.
Cricket has been getting popular among the younger generation. So, for example, cricket today in the U.S. is where soccer was, say, 20 years ago. So we hope that if we can popularize the game among the younger generation, it will pick up and it will take off.
What has been driving the growth here?
The growth has mostly been driven by immigrants coming from different cricket-playing nations. So if you, during the summer months, if you go to many parks in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, you will see cricket being played, and most of the players are coming from India, Pakistan, or West Indies, or England. So we formed this National Cricket League here in Milwaukee in order to change that. We would like to encourage and have the younger generation, native-born Americans, play the game. And in fact, we have been successful to some extent. In Waukesha, for example, we are basically offering this game to high school students. We are training them how to play, and we are also arranging tournaments. So it's getting popular.
Who do you find is attracted to cricket? There are many other sports that young people could play in this country. What's attracting them to cricket, and who makes a good cricket player?
Okay. There is some similarity between cricket and baseball. So those who play baseball, we have seen that they are interested in playing cricket. Plus, also, it's a new game. You know, teenagers are obviously, you know, attracted to something new. So we do get a lot of interest.
Well, and interestingly, I know there was some effort some time ago for baseball to attract cricket players from other parts of the world to baseball. And so it's interesting to see that in this country, there's an effort to attract baseball players to cricket.
Yes. And we think that those who are interested in baseball, they'll find a lot of things common in cricket, and they'll pick up the game.
How difficult is it to find space to play? You need a lot of room to play cricket.
Yes, we do need a lot of room. Fortunately, the Milwaukee County, as well as the city of Milwaukee, they have been very helpful to us. There are several parks in Milwaukee which has been dedicated to playing cricket. The city and also the county, they have helped us in developing the field. So we have got a lot of help.
Well, and as far as sports go, there's not a lot of infrastructure you need to have a cricket pitch, right? It's not like having a football field or even a baseball field.
Yes, we do need a pitch. And then the outfield needs to be a little bit sort of smooth and flat. But yes, we can play anywhere as long as we have a pitch.
Well, and you mentioned there's this effort to have high schoolers play in Waukesha. What are the fields like? Do you have access to fields in Waukesha County as well?
Yes, we are working with some high schools in Waukesha, and they have helped us in developing some field. What we do is now we play on AstroTurf. So it costs about $3,000, $4,000 to put on a AstroTurf field. So a couple of $1,000s, basically, we can develop a field.
So if there is not yet a professional cricket league here, what is the significance of the group of teams that will be part of this event in early July?
What we are arranging here is, for the first time in this country, we are having a state versus state tournament where eight teams from 8 different states are going to participate, including Wisconsin. So we are very excited. And what we have done is we are working with the U.S. Cricket Association, that's the central body, which is based in New York. And what we are trying to do is sort of set up a pipeline where, you know, good players who play in this league, they can eventually play for the U.S. national team.
For people who have not watched cricket, this is a sport where matches can last a long time, depending on what rules are being followed. What version of the game will make up this this league?
Okay. The version that we are playing here is what we call the T20 version, where each team will play 20 overs, and usually it runs for about 3 to 4 hours.
And I guess for people who aren't familiar with what an over is, compare it to baseball,
okay.
Say.
An over in cricket is where one bowler will bowl 6 balls. 6 balls make an over. So each team will bat for 20 overs in this case. And then once they play their 20-over turn, then the other team will play for 20 overs.
And this is, again, one of the things that distinguishes it from baseball. Essentially, a team takes care of essentially all its overs at once before the other team bats.
Yes, yes. And it's only one innings that each team plays.
Right. We have, of course, spoken with you in the past about economics. How long has cricket been an important part of your life?
When I was growing up in Bangladesh, I played cricket. So, and Bangladesh is one of the 10 teams that are playing in this World Cup tournament in England later this month. So I have been interested in cricket from my young age. So when we came here, I tried to sort of play cricket. We played cricket informally in different places. And now that I don't play anymore, so I'm more interested in organizing the game.
Well, you mentioned there is a U.S. Cricket Association.
Yes.
And the aim is to develop a pipeline to have a quality U.S. national team. Is there a U.S. national team today?
Yes, there is a U.S. national team. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, they qualified to play in what we call the ODI internationally. So U.S. national team is coming up, and they're doing very well.
What do you find is the biggest challenge in attracting Americans to cricket?
Obviously, the biggest challenge is familiarity. They're not familiar with the game, so we have to teach them. That's one thing that we are working on. And also, we need some sponsors to help us along the way. And we are getting some sponsors, but we do need some more.
Well, and so what would you say the ultimate objective of this First National Cricket League is?
The ultimate objective is to popularize the game. As we talked earlier, there are very few people in Milwaukee who are familiar with the game. We want that to change. So we will be playing this tournament, these games, in 3 different parks in Milwaukee: Lincoln Park, Lindsay Park, and Tipaconi Park. And it's open to the public. It's free. It will be played from July 4th through 7th. So it's a holiday period. And we hope that people will come to watch the game and root for different state teams.
Well, and do I understand it's going to be broadcast as well?
Yes, there'll be a live broadcast. It'll be streamed all over the country. So, you know, that's why we are looking for sponsors who will help us in sponsoring the game. And they will be, you know, they will have a nationwide
opportunity to see it.
Exactly.
Well, and you mentioned this hope that that you can develop a pipeline for the U.S. Mm-hmm. national team. In looking into this, I gather there's also some hope that there might be a professional league within 5 or 6 years?
Yes, and that's another plan we have. These 8 teams that are coming to play in this tournament, we have formed a franchise with these teams. So now we have 8 franchise teams. We plan to extend that in the future. And yes, we would like to have this played every year.
You mentioned the high school level, but I gather to really develop quality players, it would help to have really developmental level programs among even younger kids?
Yes, and that's what we are trying to do. Basically, we are trying to establish an academy, cricket academy, where we will be able to train players at different levels and start from a young age.
How difficult is it to get cricket equipment in this country?
It's not difficult. There are a lot of online sites where you can buy cricket equipment. So getting equipment is not difficult at all.
All right. So as someone who has been a lifelong player and fan and now administrator of cricket, Tell us, I guess, put into words what attracts you to the sport, you know, versus soccer or baseball or any other sport. What makes it an appealing sport to you?
I'm also interested in soccer. And since I grew up with cricket, so obviously I have a sort of a keen interest in the game. It's a competition, and it's not as physical as some of the other games, for example. So the chances of getting injured, I'd say, is much lower than in some of the games.
And there's a certain gracefulness to it as
yes,
well.
Yes, it is. It is. When we were growing up, cricket was played in the long format. A game would go on for 5 days. Now that has changed. We have much shorter format. So it's now much more attractive for audiences.
Does the version that's played, that you'll be playing in this league, does it include a break for tea?
It does. After a team plays for 20 overs, which I would say takes about 1.5 hours to 2 hours, there will be a 15-minute break.
And this, you know, the idea of breaking for tea seems very foreign to people in this country, but it's not really any different than halftime.
Yes, exactly. It's like halftime where. Going back to this tournament that we're arranging from July 4th to 7th, there will be food available. So audiences who come to watch the game, they will have, you know, they can buy foods. There'll be other type of entertainments too.
What parts of the country is cricket the strongest in?
I would say New York and Florida are the places where cricket is the strongest. In Florida, for example, you have a lot of players from the Caribbean who plays. In New York, you have a lot of players from other countries, England, Australia, who plays. So those are, I would say, the most popular areas for cricket.
So for people going to this, league, the favorites, if you will be the teams from Florida and New York, you would think?
We really don't know at this point, but yeah, we do have a team from Florida, so I'm assuming that they will have a strong team.
Well, Dr. Abdur Chaudhry, thank you so much. Best of luck with this, and honestly, it would be great to see cricket take off here.
Yeah, thank you very much for this opportunity to come and talk to you and our audiences about cricket.
And I guess I meant to ask, how long has this been has this been in the works? How long have you been planning?
Actually, we formed the National Cricket League about 3 years ago, and we had a dream at that time that very soon we'll be able to arrange this state-level game. And it has been in the work for, I would say, the last 2 years.
Well, it must be exciting to see it almost here.
Yes, we are very excited about this.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Abdur Chaudhry is a professor emeritus of economics at Marquette University, and he's the president of the National Cricket League, Incorporated. You can find out more about the Cricket World Cup and the Milwaukee National Cricket League competition in July at WUWM.com. We will take one last break, and then as Native American languages are facing extinction, local groups are working to change that. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect, I'm Bonnie North. Thousands of years before white settlers came here, Native American tribes lived in areas throughout Wisconsin. Today, tribes continue to make their homes here, but much has changed. Through decades of forced assimilation, Native American cultures were suppressed, including their languages. Some Native languages are now considered extinct. In Wisconsin, about 5 Native languages are still spoken, but some have fewer than 5 people who are considered first language speakers. Tom Tolan is the managing editor for Milwaukee Magazine, and he authored a piece on the local efforts to save these languages. Lake Effect's Joy Power sat down with him, and he explained why he decided to write the story.
About a year ago, I think in the June edition last year, I did a story about Milwaukeeese, the terms that Milwaukeeans use. And I know WUWM has done really nice work on that as well. And I got in touch with a guy named Joel Salmons, who's a linguist at UW-Madison. I emailed him. He's one of the 3 authors of a book called Wisconsin Talk. He emailed me back, but so did his wife. And his wife is another linguist named Monica McCauley, who is also, and I quoted her a lot, and she emailed me back and said, After you get finished with Joe, you ought to talk to me about native languages, because that's even, well, I'm not sure she said even more interesting, but she said as interesting at least. So that's how I got into this. And I took many months, you know, gathering wool on this probably more time than I needed to, but it just was fascinating to get into. And I hope I've done it justice. Yeah, at least five languages are spoken in Wisconsin. There's a couple others that are, there are attempts at reviving them, but I wouldn't say they're really spoken.
Yeah, what was surprising in reading the article was, you know, you mentioned the five languages, and then you mentioned, like, how many first language speakers there are. And I knew it was going to be a small amount, but I was very surprised at how small on some of them.
Five and for the Menominee and seven for the Potawatomi, I think it was. And maybe 35 or 40 for the Ojibwe, who are a much bigger tribe than all the others. But the vast majority of their first language speakers are up in Canada, where there's a number of bands scattered around the country.
Well, and this article is really touching on the effort to change that.
Right.
So you focus on all of these immersion schools. For people who might not be familiar with them as they pertain to language, what is an immersion school?
Well, we have some in Milwaukee. We've got the French language immersion school. I think there's a German one in MPS and Spanish. So, for example, a Fratney school in the River West neighborhood, one day they're doing all their classes in Spanish, and another day they're doing all of them in English. Well, this one at the Lacouture Ojibwe Reservation, the Waduka Dating School is the immersion school there, and they're speaking only Ojibwe. The teachers are speaking only Ojibwe during class time. I think for the younger grades, the kids aren't fluent in Ojibwe yet, or aren't conversant in Ojibwe, so they're allowed to speak a little English in their classes. But the idea is to get them used to using the language, and by the time they graduate, they're conversational in that language.
For most of the students, this is not a language that they're going home and speaking, although they may be Ojibwe. What happened to the Ojibwe language and many Native American languages that caused them to become either extinct in some cases or endangered?
Well, part of it is the United States government. In the late 1800s and the early 1900s, there were a bunch of Indian schools set up by the government. And the point of these schools was to scrub these kids of their native culture. They thought they'd be better Americans if they assimilated to American culture. So they were, many of these schools, they were punished for speaking their native languages. And I've heard from people that, you know, this would be the generation of the grandparents or the great-grandparents of people that are alive now. But I've heard from many people that their grandparents or great-grandparents did not teach them in the language because they were somehow had been taught to be ashamed of it. So that's a big part. And then just American culture has taken over many, you know, just like in the rest of Wisconsin, you just don't hear as much German as you did 100 years ago. It's just the American culture is dominant.
You know, why is this something that people are trying to preserve? It's something that you address inside of the article that the reason why people want to preserve the Ojibwe language is because it is integral to their culture.
Yeah. It's really a way of looking at the world. And so the natural world, you know, one of the guys that I interviewed, Michael Sullivan, who's a PhD linguist up in Lacouture, he assesses the language abilities of the kids in that school. And they'll talk about maple sugaring, which is one of the sort of the basic cultural activities that they do, or, you know, gathering wild rice. So there's specific Ojibwe words for that. But also Ojibwe is used, but it is also true of Potawatomi and Menominee. The language is used in their religious ceremonies. And it's the people who are who believe in those religions. You know, the ceremonies have to be in the native language. There's a guy named Jim Thunder who is an elder up in Forest County Potawatomi tribe. He says, when God doesn't hear our language spoken, he'll consider our tribe to be extinct. So it's spiritual matters and also, you know, cultural matters. It's the way that the culture, it's the, I don't know, the lifeblood of their culture, the languages.
Yeah. Now, we've been talking about Wadugadatin.
Uh-huh.
But Wadugadatin is just part of a much larger cultural movement among many tribes. What are some of the other immersion schools that we have here in Wisconsin?
I wrote a good deal about the Menominee. A guy named Ron Korn Jr. trains people up there. He's the head of that language department is Joey Awanape. But anyway, they have, in the last couple of years, they've been running an immersion daycare in which the teachers are all trained in Menominee. And like in Lac-Courtier, they speak only Menominee to their little kids that are, you know, it's 0 to 2 years old this year. Next year, they're planning to add another class. But they're all pleased with what's, you know, kids respond to orders or to requests. Even if they're not speaking yet, they respond to prompts in Menominee. You know, and Ron told me that when the kids are out and there's a get-together, a tribal get-together, the elders will speak to them, the kids in Menominee, and the kids will respond. So there's a lot of excitement about that, according to Ron.
We also have a program, we have a school here in the Milwaukee area over in Franklin, which is taking a slightly different approach.
Yeah, it would be impractical for the Indian Community School, which is a beautiful campus out in Franklin. It would be impractical for them to do immersion programs. They teach every kid in that school takes a language. Currently, they've got Ojibwe, Menominee, and Oneida being taught there. I haven't checked in lately, but they were very close the last time I talked to them to adding Ho-Chunk, to adding a teacher of Ho-Chunk to the school. And so that would be good. That would be four languages. But it would be hard to get people to teach mathematics, you know, all the other language arts, and that sort of, all those other grade school classes in the native language. So I don't think that they're graduating kids that are as proficient in their languages as the kids up in Lac-Courtier. But their goal now is to graduate kids that are conversational in the language with the hope that some of those kids will be motivated enough to become fluent. And it's interesting, they told me that this is a fairly new curriculum that they're developing, or a new way of teaching. I don't think they use the word curriculum. But they did a tour of all the tribes in the state, and they told me that every one of those, they had, you know, discussions with all of them about, you know, what they should be doing here down in Milwaukee. And every conversation involved the importance of language for each of these tribes. So they took that to heart, and that's now their goal.
What is the hope for these programs moving forward? It seems like all of them are in very different stages of development, especially when we're looking at a school like the Indian Community School, which serves so many different tribes.
Yeah, what is the goal? I guess the goal is to get, it's not just to learn the language, it's to be immersed in the culture. And so it's that each of these tribes is proud of their culture, and they want their kids to be proud of the culture. And, you know, in Indian country, there are many problems that, you know, alcohol and drugs and historically poverty, you know, it just makes sense for people to be proud of who they are and what their heritage is. And that's, you know, I'm a white guy, so I'm not sure I can speak properly on this, but I think, as I pointed out in the story, that there have been studies of people that speak a native language, and they found that people who do speak a native language in these tribal areas are less likely to be suicidal, to use drugs, and even less likely to have diabetes. I don't know how that works, but that's what the studies say. So there's many benefits even beyond just knowing your language and your culture.
Yeah. Well, Tom Tolan, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, I was happy to be here, Joy. Thanks.
Tom Tolan is the managing editor for Milwaukee Magazine and the author of the article Rekindling the Fires. To hear more of our conversations with Milwaukee Magazine, head over to WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm glad to have you with us, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.